I want to just start where we stopped yesterday in terms of the political spectrum. We had the right wing, the Conservative Party, then the nationalists, who are, in any normal society, would be the extreme right wing, are kind of in the middle of white politics. The Progressive Federal Party, who are a kind of liberal party. And then to the left, you have the two main tendencies, the black consciousness groupings, the Pan-African Congress and the National Forum, and the Charterist and or non-racial groupings, the African National Congress and the United Democratic Front. I just want to leave that up there to keep in the back of our minds. Okay, the church in South Africa. I've been mentioning to people that the church, very similar to the colonization of South Africa, the church in South Africa follows very similar patterns to that in America at some levels. Whites have been in South Africa as long as they've been in America. They came in the same kinds of waves and the same kinds of issues in Europe that sent people to America also sent them to South Africa. The early church can really be divided into two types of churches in South Africa, known as the mission churches and the settler churches. The mission churches were churches in England and Scotland and America sending missionaries to the African continent, Southern Africa, South Africa, to evangelize whatever they did with the blacks in South Africa. Okay, missions. The settler churches were those white people who came from Europe or England or Scotland to South Africa and brought their denominations with them. Okay, and I've used an example of my own church, the Congregational Church. When a large number of British settlers came to South Africa at the closing of the Napoleonic Wars, 1820, and they were Methodists and Congregationalists and Presbyterians and Anglicans, Episcopalians, the whole works. And so let's say a couple of white settlers came out who were Congregationalists from the British Congregational Church, and they would have brought with them a pastor, or they would have requested a pastor to come with them. At the same time, the British Congregational Church back in England had its missionary wing. Remember, the 19th century was the age of missions. The London Missionary Society, David Livingstone, Moffat, those kind. And they were Congregationalists in Africa, in South Africa, evangelizing the blacks, who were responsible to the missionary society of the body back in England. And in fact, the Congregational Church in New England, under the American Board of Christian Foreign Missions, also did the same. So you had both British and American Congregationalists converting blacks, but there were white Congregationalists going on as well, the mission and the settler churches. That's a really important tension to understand in South Africa, because in many ways it remains. Now, this would be true for the what are known as the English-speaking churches, the churches that come from English-speaking part of the world. Congregationalists, Methodists from England, Presbyterians from Scotland, what we call Anglicans or Episcopalians from England as well. So they all spoke English as their language. The Catholics came from, not Ireland, but from, I was going to say Israel, but I mean Italy. The Lutherans came from Germany. But they kind of followed the same pattern, which is why I've got a little arrows going both ways. I just wanted to show that these are historically two different movements of church. Although the Catholic, Lutheran, and Episcopalian church understanding enabled them to have less of a divide between mission and settler churches. Because, for example, the Catholics is the best example. The Mass was said in Latin, whether you were from England, from Italy, or a Xhosa-speaking or Zulu-speaking South African. So it didn't, and the priest kind of sat up there and you just came to Mass, and your church didn't mean anything else. It didn't have a kind of culture attached to it in the way that the settlers wanted to maintain their culture and their church, and the missionaries kind of felt that they should look after these poor blacks in their churches. But now the other main wing of churches in South Africa are known within the Afrikaans-speaking world, or the Dutch Reformed Church. Okay? DRC, Dutch Reformed Church, or in Afrikaans, the Nederduitse Gereformeerde Kerk, which is basically Dutch Reformed Church. Came from Holland. The first Dutch settlers arrived in the Cape in 1652. So that's a long time ago, and the church came with them. Slowly but surely, and then kind of established itself. When the British, interestingly enough, when the British colonized the Cape, they didn't allow any more Dutch pastors in. The Dutch Reformed Church turned to the Presbyterian Church in Scotland to send English-speaking Reformed pastors to the church. But one of the differences between these two is that these all arrived after the Enlightenment and these before. Now, some of you might be saying, what the hell does that mean? Well, the thing is, in Europe, the Enlightenment kind of opened Christianity up to questions of evolution, biblical criticism, science, sociology, primitive as it may have been. And that meant that missionaries who came out in the 19th century were kind of, generally we call them liberal Protestants. I mean, they sort of felt that Christianity and Western civilization came together and the two informed each other, and to be a good Christian was to be a good gentleman, a good English-speaking gentleman, preferably. Open doors for ladies. Whereas the Dutch Reformed Church came probably at the height when, before the Enlightenment, of the Reformed tradition being at its most conservative. And because it had come to South Africa and broken ties with Holland, it wasn't influenced by the Enlightenment at all. Okay, does that make some kind of sense to you? Mm-hmm. And it sort of was transplanted, and then, because it didn't have a constant flow of missionaries and thought and whatever, it never really, the Enlightenment never affected it that much. And also you have to understand that up until the turn of this century, there were probably fewer than 10 Afrikaans-trained ministers, theologians. The average pastor was just your, in good Calvinist understanding, your layperson who happened to be with his settler group out in the middle of the wilderness with the Bible in one hand. And that was your theology, you know. Now they had the settler church known as the Mother Church. And then by quirk of South African history, when the Dutch... Sorry, I've got to add this all in because it makes part of the mosaic. When the English colonized the Cape, the Dutch tried to escape from the English and went further north. But the Dutch Reformed Church said, no, we're not going to follow you. So they simply started their own churches, the Nederduitse Gereformeerde Kerk and the Gereformeerde Kerk, two other denominations. But they're all part of the Dutch Reformed Church, and they're all settler churches, white churches. But then the Dutch Reformed Church had its own missions. To the colored people, the Nederduitse Gereformeerde Sendingkerk, sending meaning mission, to send. The Reformed Church in Africa, and the Indian Reformed Church, coloreds, blacks, Indians. Okay, it's a particular kind of mission understanding, which is not unknown even in this world today. There's a school of mission that believes that churches grow best when they're homogenous, when they're made up of the same people culturally and language-wise. And that's no different to this idea that simply churches grow best when blacks make up one church and Indians another and colored another. Okay, so you have at the turn of the century in South Africa, just to telescope things down, within the churches across the board, this mission church, settler church, black church, white church, to a large extent. Then what happens in the history is that these churches unite the mission and the settler churches and become what are known in now in South Africa as the mainline denominations. Anglican, Methodist, Congregational, Presbyterian, Catholic, Lutheran, Baptist, the works. Okay, and these are the mainline denominations, and they made up historically of the mission wing of the church and the settler wing of the church. But what happened in the Dutch Reformed Church is that that move was never made. That the mission church and the mother churches, well, the mission churches and the mother church didn't unite. And that brings me to where I want to start with some of the contemporary debate in South Africa, because at the time that the Nationalist Party, the Nats, one known colloquially as the Nats, came to power in 1948 in South Africa, the situation looked pretty much like this, church-wise. The Dutch Reformed Church was not a particularly conservative church. I want to read you something from another book that is... I want to recommend... This is Desmond Tutu himself, Hope and Suffering. And he quotes in a paper that he delivers to a government commission of inquiry into the South African Council of Churches. And he quotes from the Dutch Reformed Church paper in the 1940s. This is the Dutch Reformed Church. The other extreme, however, is still more fatal to the church's effective witness to the world, and that is acquiescence in unjust conditions. Silence may never be kept about the social implications of the gospel of Christ. There can be little doubt that the present low level of the spiritual life is in no small measure due to the dilution of the eternal principles. The charge against the church. The strongest charge against the church is born exactly out of the conception of many that she has not grieved over the ruin of Joseph, but acquiesced in this in the conditions of injustice, exploitation, and coercion. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in 1931 made a survey in the vast suburb of Berlin among 1,000 former members who had left the church. Not one of them recorded objections against the doctrines of the church as a reason for cessation. The great charge was that the church had no eye or ear for justice or for the oppressed. And there's a whole statement on the church has got to be a church of the poor and the oppressed, because at that point the Afrikaans community was a community of poor and oppressed people. But they had come to power now, 1948, and the Dutch Reformed Church lent its divisions, white, colored, black, and Indian, to the political setup. And you had basically then in a church confrontation and standoff, the Dutch Reformed Church here over against the mainline denominations who now came together in the South African Council of Churches. Although the Catholics, because of Vatican policy, are not part of the Council of Churches, like in this country. And this... The basic issue over which this fight took place was the question of the theological legitimacy of apartheid, the policy that came into being through the South African government and supported by the Dutch Reformed Church. 1961 was Sharpeville. 1960, actually, the end of 1960 was Sharpeville. And that kind of exploded in the world situation. I talked a little bit about that yesterday. The World Council of Churches, to which, interestingly enough, all these churches belonged at that stage, called a commission of inquiry. Visser ter Hoef, the one-time president or general secretary, came, and there was a big consultation called the Cottesloe Consultation. And all the churches there, except for these two, who pulled out of the discussion, but including the Dutch Reformed Church, condemned the political implications of apartheid. Beyers Naudé, is that a name familiar to people? Beyers Naudé, who was then a high-up member of the white Dutch Reformed Church, was instrumental in getting his group to actually support the Cottesloe consultation. For the first time, the church had said that apartheid is evil, unjust. But within a day of that being published, the Prime Minister of South Africa repudiated the church and called on the church to reject its statement, and the church did. But Beyers Naudé and two other people of that group that had attended Cottesloe refused to recant. And that was the beginning of his long pilgrimage to become finally the president of the South African Council of Churches. And to become one of the, to be banned, to be raided, have his offices raided, to become a real pariah in the eyes of the government. But that was a really important issue in South Africa. But it took a couple of years for people to start questioning, now, it's not only the effects of apartheid that are wrong, but what about the system itself? It's given Christian legitimation. Is it Christian? Does it have a biblical basis? The biblical basis given was that in Genesis, in the chapter 11, God wills the separation of peoples. That's the story of the Tower of Babel. Okay, that it's God's will for humankind that people speak different languages, have different cultures, live in different parts of the world. And in fact, at Pentecost, it's shown there that the church speaks in different languages to be heard by different cultures and different people. And the church must therefore be of different languages and different cultures. That's recognized. That's what God wants. And people must be separated in that sense. That's the basic theological justification of apartheid. 1968, under the auspices of the South African Council of Churches and an organization founded by this Beyers Naudé called the Christian Institute of South Africa, a document was published called A Message to the People of South Africa. And for the first time now, it wasn't just the effects of apartheid, but apartheid itself that was called into question from a theological point of view. And the word used was a pseudo-gospel. That apartheid is a pseudo-gospel. Can you understand the shift there? I mean, it's one thing, let's say, to say from a Christian point of view that Reagan's covert activities in Nicaragua are wrong and unjust. It's another thing to have to move to the situation where a whole intricate system of theology is actually used to legitimate that and to say that that theology is a pseudo-gospel. Can you see the difference of the move there?
I'm confused, Steve, because I don't know where you explained the theological rationale. Where did it come from?
Okay, it basically came from within the Dutch Reformed Church in the 40s.
In the 40s, yeah.
At the time that Afrikanerdom was there was a real resurgence of the Afrikaner spirit. Remember, this is the time of Hitler at Nuremberg, the time of nation and folk. A number of German intellectuals Afrikaner intellectuals have studied in Germany under the great German philosophers. The German spirit, the people, the folk, the nation, this is what God wants. We are the pinnacle. There's some real connections here. And a number of the real theologians and philosophers, in fact, even some prime ministers of South Africa, studied in Germany at the time of the whole resurgence of German nationalism. So this whole
idea... A form out of the Nazi...
There's some very close connections. But the idea that God has willed a separate people with its own history to occupy a certain space with its own heroes and its own understanding is so important to understand. And especially if you've got a history of being bashed by the British, which is both the German experience at Versailles and the Afrikaner experience. For 100 years, the British went after them all the time and then tried to get their gold from them. I mean, it's this feeling.
And so even though the English are culpable, in one sense, the apartheid theology is a Dutch...
Yeah. Although you'll find various missionaries in South Africa use the same kind of language about the British themselves, you know. In fact, the earliest critiques of the Dutch Reformed Church come from the missionaries, but when you read it closely, it's because they believe they, as English-speaking people, have the right to evangelize, not the others. Okay. But you have a standoff here now on the question of apartheid and on the question of the integrity of the church and the gospel. Now, this is 1968. It's 30 years after the whole German thing that we've just talked about. The church is looking for models that it's going to use. And the most obvious one is the confessing church in Germany. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Niemöller, Karl Barth, the Bauman Declaration, the whole Christian struggle against Hitler. And if you think about it, I mean, the parallels have just been drawn and illustrated here. The whole question of race, of folk, you know, the German and Afrikaans word for people, kind of carries so much more than just people, but it's the nation, the church, race, the gospel is all involved in this, and these are precisely the questions that this group of younger South African theologians discover were dealt with by the German church. Okay, the whole introduction of the Jewish question is the racial question. The nation, the folk, was so important in the way that Hitler used the church. It's a question of the integrity of the gospel. So you get in this first phase of the South African struggle what is known as the church struggle in South Africa, and that's where the title of this book comes from, because what it was called in Germany was the Kerkenkampf, the church struggle. And this title is, in fact, I know because I was part of the discussion, a deliberate attempt to ally the church struggle in South Africa with the Kerkenkampf in Germany. It's, you know, my father did his PhD on Bonhoeffer, and he's written a book called Bonhoeffer in South Africa. And when he was growing up as a young theologian in the early 60s, that was the stuff that they were reading. You know, not only him, but his colleagues and the ministers, the younger growing group of people who now were trying to have a South African theology. And they were being influenced by this tremendous witness of the Christians in Germany. So that sets the scene. And the real debate here is then over the question of the legitimacy of apartheid as a theology and the question of the gospel. And it has a kind of history that's checkered. It begins in 1968 with the message to the people of South Africa. It gets lost a little bit, it gets recaptured, it gets lost. But all the time, it's set the agenda. You can't evade it. You have to deal with it if you're a South African theologian. The whole generation of people who taught me in South Africa, my theology, were all the products of the message to the people of South Africa. The church conferences from then on, if you look, the themes all start changing. The people who become prominent are people who signed the message to the people of South Africa. It's a whole generation of an agenda that is set. And it reaches its prominence in a battle that rages between the mission churches and the settler church. And this was captured, those of you who follow anything in the Reformed tradition, in the World Alliance of Reformed Churches, in a debate between Alan Busack and the Dutch Reformed, white Dutch Reformed churches. Over the question of, here we are, it's not even that you're Dutch Reformed and we're Lutheran. You're Dutch Reformed, we're Dutch Reformed. We both have the same confession. We both study the same theology. We both have the same liturgy. The only thing that's separating us out is race. Why cannot we unite like has happened here? And this became the real focus of the whole apartheid as a heresy debate. The discussion of apartheid sets up a situation whereby what became known in theological jargon as an ecclesiastical heresy. Does that make any sense to you? Ecclesiastical meaning the church. It means that Christ's death on the cross, which came to unite both Jew and Gentile, you know, the Ephesians 2 passage, is meaningless. Because within the same denomination, whites and blacks cannot worship together, cannot share the common cup. And it was illustrated most dramatically at the World Alliance of Reformed Churches in Ottawa in 1982, when the representatives from these churches have refused to take communion, so long as the representatives of these churches were taking communion at the same cup. And they were doing, I mean, it was a symbolic action to raise this whole thing. So, what you have here is a kind of, these churches set the agenda in the debate, but it really gets sharpened by this younger group of black Dutch Reformed ministers, Alan Busack, Sean Govender, who's an Indian, Sam Booty, who's an African, really trying to bring this thing to a head and to make a statement over and against the Dutch Reformed Church that this theology is a heresy. Okay, and the theologians argued it back that if the church couldn't be had to be separated, then Christ's saving death on the cross to constitute the new redeemed community was irrelevant, and if Christ's death on the cross is irrelevant, well then that becomes what's known as a soteriological heresy. And if that's irrelevant, then in fact Christ's life is irrelevant, and you build it back to become a Christological heresy. Can you see the sort of line of argument that went on there? And people kind of breathed a sigh of relief. You know, the church struggle is now over. Well, the arrows go on. So the story goes on. What's happening in this debate is that those issues that I talked about, race, and the integrity of the church and the gospel have met and become discussed. But it's almost, you get this feeling, especially if you're involved in theology in South Africa, that it's almost once you've closed the book on that you actually realize that there's a whole world going out there and people are running around with guns, killing other people. Which is not to say that this debate didn't have political significance at all. I mean, it had a tremendous amount of political significance. But the question was raised, well, okay, so I'm a domestic servant living in a white, affluent, English-speaking suburb. What the heck does the declaration that apartheid is a heresy actually mean to me? Well, I'm a migrant laborer. Okay, so the World Alliance of Reformed Churches has said that apartheid is a heresy. Wonderful, you know. Or I'm a white conscript with a gun in my hand. Ah, did you hear the World Alliance of Reformed Churches said apartheid is a heresy, you know? Amazing, isn't it? Can you see what I'm getting at? It's happening up here. It's in the realms of theology. Sure, it takes the wind out of the sails, and the history of the Dutch Reformed Church since then has been fascinating as it's kind of wheedled its way out of all of that. But it doesn't actually mean anything to those people on the ground. And that was heightened by the fact that just at that period, the Boerter's reforms, I talked about that last night, came into being. The United Democratic Front was launched. Politics in South Africa became bloody business. People were being shot. Troops occupied the townships. Consumer boycotts were called. The church was called on to take sides. And the whole question was raised, well, what is the meaning of this? And then there's a kind of a subtle shift here from using the German confessing church as a model. People like myself who maybe come studied for a year here in the United States or studied in Latin America or studied in Germany, that's kind of the next generation of theologians. Well, the people we read are not, I mean, we read our Barth and our Bonhoeffer, but we're reading Gustavo Gutierrez, we're reading the Latin American liberation theologians, James Cone, black theologians, we're reading our own theologians, and we're starting to say, well, the German church and the confessing struggle against Hitler is a good model, but 6 million Jews still died in concentration camps. And in fact, there's a fascinating statistic that more than 1,000 confessing church German pastors died bearing arms for Hitler, compared to only 10 who died as conscientious objectors or as people against Hitler. So even within the confessing church, the patriotism was so strong, and the fact that it was conceived as a kind of integrity of the church and the gospel, and we've got to safeguard that, but then as good Germans, good Lutherans, you know, this is the realm of the state, and we must go and fight. And this is what liberation theology has been kind of challenging, and it's come through in South Africa as we've started to raise that question, what does this mean to the washerwoman, or to the migrant laborer, or to the conscript with the gun? And it's meant that people have started to stand back and look at what's actually happening in the South African church politically. And I've drawn some sort of arrows here because I wanted to show where the church has got to now, or where the church is understood to be at the moment. Instead of just the two parties, the goodies and the baddies, okay, everybody over and against the poor Afrikaans Dutch Reformed people who are trying to maintain their integrity in a hostile world, the younger theologians, black theologians to a large extent, have pointed a finger at the white English-speaking theologians and said, and churches, you thought you were in the forefront of the struggle, you know, fighting the Dutch Reform. Well, let me tell you, you're just as racist as they are. And you've stomped on us just as much as they are. And as far as we're concerned, you're part of the problem, not part of the solution. Okay, can you see that happening? And that's meant that one's had to rewrite the church thing, and one's got to draw the lines differently. And the way it's come out is that we have three churches now instead of two. The one, if we wanted to call it radical, the other, reformist, and the other, reactionary, just to use three R's. Okay. If you've ever read any of José Miguez Bonino's books, you'll know that that's the point he makes in doing theology in a revolutionary situation, that everybody, up until this point, a lot of people have thought that there's the conservative church and the liberal church. But in fact, the liberals are part of the problem, and you need to understand that there are three churches occupying three political positions. And this is where I wanted to, why I drew these arrows up here. Because you see, in the South African situation, and the reason I drew these arrows from the mission over to the English-speaking church, is that when these unities took place, the theologians were all English-speaking whites. The church administrators were all English-speaking whites. The universities catered to English-speaking whites. The church leadership became English-speaking whites. The bishops were English-speaking whites. The theologians were. The teachers were. So, although you had kind of these non-racial churches, they were pretty much controlled by a white agenda, politically speaking and theologically speaking. Okay. And what's been happening in this past generation is that, and this is why I've tried to draw the arrows from the mission church, those blacks who originally made up the mission churches, certainly some from within the white English-speaking churches, the African independent churches and the African Pentecostal churches, have been kind of coalescing under, you can't see it very clearly here, but black and African theology. Okay, making a critique over and against the white leadership of the non-racial denominations. Okay, for example, the Anglican Church in South Africa is 2 million people, about 1.5 million are black. But up until this point, until Desmond Tutu was elected Archbishop, the Archbishop has always been a white person, and the bishops have always generally been white people. So that's part of the critique that's being made. The blacks within the Dutch Reformed wing, this is where the arrows get a little bit complicated, but if you remember that these are mission, these come out of the mission tradition like this, are part of that. That's where the arrow goes. The English-speaking whites, who politically have been allied with the PFP, have kind of ended up in a reformist position, which is in fact the PFP's political stance. kind of a liberal, let's change some things, but the reason it's called the Progressive Federal Party is it wants a federal system in South Africa rather than a one person, one vote. It's a it's very complicated, but they don't want one person, one vote. And then you have on this side the reactionary church. And then, of course, this side here makes up the radical position. And then within the radical position, this is where it gets very complicated. The black consciousness people talk about black theology, and the non-racial people talk about liberation theology. Okay. So again, remember yesterday we talked about it in terms of trade unions and political organizations. Well, you can talk about it in theology too. If you're a black consciousness person and belong to the National Forum, the theology you do is black theology. If you're a black person and belong to the non-racial groups, the United Democratic Front, then you tend to call what you do liberation theology. Okay, although it's pretty much the same kind of thing.
Are there white people, Steve, and doing radical
theology? Yeah, I want to come to that now. And this is where I want to just finish off now, because this is really the present state of the South African church struggle at the moment and the conflict that's going on. Is that, and this is what the Kairos document says in just as many words, that it divides the South African church up into three types of theology. State theology, church theology, and prophetic theology. And we're going to have more chance to actually look at that in a time. But the question it's raising, and this is the real agenda for South Africa, just like the message to the people of South Africa was in 68, is let's have another look at this church. It's not as you who wrote our theology and who led our churches and who made our statements for us said it was. It's not we the goodies, the English-speaking whites, against they the baddies, the Afrikaans-speaking whites. In fact, what you offer as political suggestions and solutions is not what we want anyway. Our political home is here. These are the political solutions we want. That our theology is connected with that, just as your theology is connected with that, and their theology is connected with that. Okay, so those kinds of questions have been raised. The Kairos document kind of sums up that kind of position, and as I say, we're going to go into it in a little bit more detail. Since this came out in 1985, there have been a couple of developments within the churches. The Congregational Church, of which I'm a part, has accepted the Kairos document as a basic study document and is trying to reshape the life of the church around it. That's the most advanced. Various other churches have kind of decided to use it as a discussion topic. The church has stepped up its repression of people who've signed this document. Not everybody. I signed it, for example, and I haven't been repressed.
Which church?
Sorry?
The state.
That's what happens when you've been talking here. The state has pressed its repression of people who signed the document. So that Frank Chikani, for example, who signed this, has been in detention three times. But he also symbolizes a very good thing in that he has now been appointed General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, this Frank Chikani, who's one of the main writers of this document. So that, with that happening and with Desmond Tutu becoming Archbishop of Cape Town, you've kind of got the makings of that the church struggle is going to be understood far more as a debate between here and here, and that these people are going to be asked to say, okay, when the chips are down, which side are you actually going to go for? I mean, it's all very well for you to say, yes, we like our blacks. But when we call for consumer boycotts and sanctions, why do you always then jump onto this side and say consumer boycotts are wrong, they hurt you, sanctions are wrong, they hurt you? Can you see that's the kind of rhetoric and the language and the debate that's going on? And then finally the well, no, let me just leave it there, and perhaps out of discussion some of the other issues will arise. It's a complicated setup, just like the political thing was last night. But I think if you can get that basic shift between using the German struggle over the integrity of the church and the question of racism in the church, and then having to deal with the fact that people are being shot on the streets and there's oppression and injustice and exploitation, and needing a theological model that is grounded far more in the lives of everyday people, and seeing that in liberation theology and black theology, and therefore re-understanding the situation, and then also the fact that, and this is why I put this up at the top, that the theological positions are basically the political positions. And that's, in fact, the world round. And, I mean, that's true for everyone here. And if it isn't, then in fact, then you've got a problem in your own head. Because if you are doing things politically that you theologically don't agree with. So, I mean, in fact, this is just an integrity model. But it raises questions of, when you think that this is the pure gospel, not allied, then that's when your problems begin. Let me stop there, and maybe we can field some questions.
Maybe you said this, but I didn't catch it. What was the signing of Kairos document? What does that mean? What is that about?
Well, the Kairos document was simply launched as a kind of statement to provide a theological resource for pastors who are ministering in the streets of Soweto, where their congregations are, and they're having to deal with the fact that, for example, they have more funerals for children than they do baptisms. Now, pastors were not equipped in their seminaries to deal with that kind of situation. So they look up their systematic theology, and they don't find the resources to preach on a Sunday morning to a congregation that's out there with the... He knows, the pastor or she knows, though in South Africa it's a he, generally speaking, that the children are not a youth group because they're out making petrol bombs or they've left the country to go and fight in the guerrillas. You have to start saying, well, what does the gospel mean? And that's where the Kairos document comes from, an attempt to say what the gospel means in that situation. And then it was circulated around the country, and people who agreed with the basic position of it were invited to sign it. And the original draft had about 100 signatories, and since then, now when they print it, this is published by Erdmans here in America, and they've left off the signatories because it's just got far too long. Okay. And I did say that next week, I think on Thursday, the fourth session next week, I'm going to actually be dealing with the Kairos document. And it is for sale in the bookstore, $2.95. Take one here and then we can.
Well, when you say the mainline denominations came together, but it's in an apartheid country, I mean, did you actually have blacks and whites in the same congregation, or did you just have organizational with some black churches? And
yeah.
Some?
Your second thing is more like it. Now, one of the things about the South African situation, and this is a very good example that this group now is criticizing this church, is that we say we're a non-racial church, that blacks and whites can belong to the denominations. But what we don't tell the world is that Group Areas Act means that coloreds must live out there, blacks must live over there, and whites must live over there. And if you're going to go to your local church, well, you're going to end up going to a white church or a colored church or a black church. So whites, English-speaking whites, can sit there and say, oh, we think it's terrible that the white Dutch Reformed Church doesn't allow blacks into its church, knowing full well that no black is going to travel 30 miles on a Sunday morning without a car to come and worship in their church. And so that's what blacks have been saying to English-speaking whites. Oh, yeah? So how different are you? You know, you mouth the platitudes about the church, but you haven't done anything to change the Group Areas Act, the political structure that is actually separating the church. It doesn't help if the church says it's undivided. If the society forces the church to be undivided, then you've got to get out there and change the society. So that's a good illustration on where black and younger theologians and Christians have been criticizing the older way of sort of clearing house for ourselves, keeping ourselves nice and pure and clean, but not dirtying our hands.
Yes, exactly.
That's not to say that people do cross the barriers. I grew up in basically a white church, although its doors were open to everybody, the Congregational Church. In fact, maybe I should give some statistics after I finish this. It'll give you a good idea of the numbers. But 2 years ago, I decided to go to a predominantly coloured church in Cape Town, and I've been worshipping there now. There's nothing to stop me doing that. Nothing. It would be difficult for me to go to a black church because I don't speak an African language at all. So there are kind of cultural things that do get into play there. Okay, let me just say that in South Africa, 77% of the people claim church affiliation. It's a basically Christian country. 77% of the people claim church affiliation. 88% of that 77% are black. That's right across the gamut. You're talking about a black church with some white people in it. Okay. But if you stop the debate here and looked at who was fighting whom and who was writing what, you would have thought, and people have this impression, that the church in South Africa is a white church. The Dutch Reformed Church is white, and the opponents seem to be white to some extent, except for Alan Busak and Desmond Tutu. But actually, as I say, 88% of the church in South Africa is black. And that includes, you see, these statistics now also include the African independent churches, which when the whites were making up the statistics were kicked out as syncretistic because they didn't adhere to any of the main white European confessions of faith. But when the blacks start writing the statistics, they say, my uncle is a pastor in the African Zionist independent church over there, and sure as hell I know he's a Christian. Do you know what I'm getting at? I mean, whites can write statistics in a way that perhaps don't represent what blacks feel about the situation. So that's what the situation shows at the moment. In terms of numbers, the Dutch Reformed, white Dutch Reformed churches together probably have about 2 million to 3 million people in them. The mission churches together probably have about 1 million. Then the easiest way to remember is Congregational, Catholic, Anglican, and Methodist all have 2 million each in them. Presbyterians have about less than 1 million, and Congregationalists and Lutherans, I think, have just a little less than the Presbyterians. And Baptists are quite small. And then you have more than 1,200 African independent denominations in South Africa.
Denominations.
But a denomination may be made up of one church. That's a good question. But it may be made up of two or three churches. Or it may even be made up of, there's one called, is Marion here? Got bored with me. Happens all the time. What is it called? It's called, there's one church anywhere that has more than 1 million, an African independent church that has more than 1 million people in it. And every Easter, they have a huge big celebration up in the Northern Transvaal. And they block up the freeways and everything going in because they transport a million people to that gathering. Mm-hmm. And the bishop preaches and whatever.
How many blacks are not Christian? How
let's work that backwards. Mm-hmm. 77 times 88 will give you the percentage of blacks who are Christians.
Oh, okay.
So that's about 60%. So about 40% of the blacks wouldn't be Christian. The rest would be made up of a few Muslims. And remember, black in that category has also been defined by blacks to include coloureds and Indians. Whereas when whites write the statistics, they divide coloureds, Indians, and blacks. It's part of the game of statistics to try and get people on your side. And then most of the rest would adhere to some form of African traditional religion and belief. In fact, it's one of the reasons that I said last night, I think I would hazard a guess that the Communist Party in South Africa is probably at the most 5,000 people out of 35 million. And the reason is simply that atheism is, you'd have to, unlike secularized Europe, Africans would actually have to learn atheism. Because the way you grow up is a belief in supreme beings. I mean, your science, your language, your everything is theistic. It might not be Christian, but it's definitely theistic. And to start actually discounting that means you cut yourself off from your people. And that's something that people often don't realize very much when they talk about the fact that communism will take a foothold in South Africa. You know, it's certainly Marxism and socialism, yes, but they don't necessarily imply atheism. Well, thank you, everybody.